Whiteman, it is great to have you on the show. On behalf of myself, Greg McKenzie, the folks at Missiology.com and Missiology Podcast, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So you are a missionary anthropologist. Is that how you would describe yourself? What would you say is your, how do you describe your career?
Well, I'm first and most part anthropologist, just a secular anthropologist,
yeah,
who happens to love Jesus and have been committed to mission all my life. So I refer to myself as a missiological anthropologist.
Okay. Yeah.
Two generations ago, they used the word missionary anthropology, but I've kind of distanced myself from that term missionary.
Yeah. Oh, so tell us about that. What is that? Is that related to colonialism? Or are you concerned about the ways that that term may be received in certain limited access countries? How is it that you've moved away from?
I moved away from it because the word missionary carries a lot of colonial baggage. Mm. And missiological is a much more accurate phrase. And I don't even use the word missionary very often. My preferred term is cross-cultural witness, which I think is a more accurate description of what God calls us to be. To witness to the power of Christ, and we do that in cross-cultural context. So in all my teaching, I just, right from the very beginning, I say, now, we're not going to use the word missionary, but you have to, of course.
Right, because everyone's still wondering, what are we talking about again? But then, to say cross-cultural witness or just talk about cross, I mean, that's also really helpful. That's useful. It's very descriptive.
Yeah.
It's more descriptive than a term like missionary is.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm curious, how is it that you got into this field? This whole idea of being an anthropologist, but doing it with God's mission in mind. How did that happen?
Well, I grew up in the Free Methodist Church, fairly conservative Wesleyan tradition. And I'd say we had a spiritual pyramid. At the top, at the bottom were lay people.
Okay, yeah.
In the middle were pastors, church workers, and at the top of the pyramid were missionaries.
Okay.
And one of my favorite lines was from Benjamin Disraeli, who said, if God calls you to be a missionary, don't stoop to be a king. Well, that's pretty heady stuff for an 18-year-old.
Right.
Now remember, it is a pyramid. So not all missionaries are equally valued in the church community.
Right.
So at the very top, almost at the top, were Wycliffe Bible translators, because you had to be smart to be able to Bible translator. But a little above that were medical missionaries.
Okay. All right.
And the reason they were at the top is because they sacrificed more than anybody else.
Right. They could be making the big bucks. They could be making, hundreds
That's
of
right.
thousands of dollars.
They could stay home for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they didn't. So I started college wanting to become a medical missionary. And my heroes were Albert Schweitzer and Paul Carlson, who was a martyr, killed in 1964. I graduated from high school in 1965. And so I knew I had to work hard to get into medical school, so I really worked hard and got a lot of A's.
Yeah. Where'd you go to school?
In my junior year.
Where did you go to school? Where was that?
My first 2 years were Spring Arbor College in Spring Arbor, Michigan.
Okay.
And that was the hometown in which I grew up. It's a Free Methodist college. And my junior year, I decided to transfer out to Seattle Pacific, also another Free Methodist school. It's there I met my wife, of 2 years younger, and now of 51 years. I was given a new advisor. His name was Frank Klein, and he had spent 25 years in India and was a really accomplished person. He was head of the School of Religion, but he'd been a friend of our family, so he said, I want to be your advisor. So he said, so what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, I want to be a medical missionary. Oh, he said, that's good. He said, then you better take a course in anthropology. I said, what? What's anthropology? I had never heard the term. I said, is that the study of bugs? I want to go someplace where there's lots of bugs. He said, no, that's the study of people and their cultures. And you won't believe that I said this, but I did. I said, is that important? Do I need to know that stuff? He said, trust me, it's important.
Yeah, yeah.
So I took this course in anthropology. It wasn't a particularly engaging textbook or a professor, but I discovered in that field a discipline that fit me as a person, hand in glove. I couldn't believe it. And so I gobbled up everything I could in anthropology, sociology, psychology. So finished, graduated 1969. That's the height of the Vietnam War. So if you didn't have a plan for your life, Uncle Sam did.
Right.
And my church invited me to go to Central Africa to help restart a mission there that had been blown out of the waters by rebel uprisings. And they needed two young men who were expendable. And so I volunteered. I got engaged to my wife, Lori, and off I went. Well, the first 6 months there, I was pretty sure I was going to come back and go to medical school because there was so much human suffering. And I thought, you know, this is worth giving my life to. Now, this is even before the HIV/AIDS had invaded the continent. So maybe I got callous to it, or I'm not quite sure what happened. But as the months went on, I started observing my missionary colleagues more closely. And they were so busy doing their Bibles, books, and Band-Aids, the three avenues of mission, that they seemed to have little interest or knowledge, really, about understanding the African people at that deep, deep worldview level. And slowly over time, I realized, you know, I need to become an anthropologist. About 2 months before I came home, I told my, I spent 2 years, and I told my missionary colleagues, so I'm going to go back and go to graduate school in anthropology, not to medical school. So how do you think they responded?
Yeah, yeah. They're like, why why the shift? You could make the big bucks. You work so hard to become
a medical
missionary.
I wanted to come back as a medical missionary. So it wasn't about money.
No, it was about the hierarchy. You just wanted to be at the top of the they said you could be
yes,
at the top.
I did.
Why would you choose to not be at the top?
So here's how they responded. They said, they made two comments. Whiteman, they said, you're going to throw your life away. We've never yet met a Christian anthropologist. Why do you think you can become the first one? Mm-hmm. Now, statistically, they were correct. There are very, very few Christian anthropologists. In fact, it's probably less than 1% of all the Christians, of all the anthropologists. And and another reason they were statistically correct is I've actually met missionaries who went and worked on a PhD in anthropology, and sure enough, they lost their faith.
Wow.
So that was the first thing they said. Then the second thing they said, well, even if you survive, you have this fancy degree and what's left of your faith, there's no value whatsoever in anthropology for mission work.
Wow.
So with that kind of encouragement.
That definitely shows, it definitely reflects the mindset at the time. Yeah, I mean, that's a... the kind of pushback that
this is 19.
Yeah, you're getting so much pushback on this. It's fascinating to see, you know, fast forward to where we are now, how much has changed. But anyway, continue. I want to hear the rest of the story. So
well, so this is 50 years later. Yeah. So I came home, got married to Lori, entered graduate school, and then I would say I entered a 10-year wilderness. The average length of time for a PhD in anthropology is 10.2 years.
That's a long time.
That's after college.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, you have to do many languages, field work, all that kind of stuff. So I like to say that I was fast. I did it in only 9. But I feel like I entered a wilderness, a 10-year wilderness, because no one believed in me. My church turned their back on me.
Really? Oh, wow.
My family didn't understand me. And I almost quit on 2 or 3 occasions, but I knew that this is what God had called me to do with no prospects or what it would mean in terms of employment, none of that stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got my start. And now looking back 50 years later, I can see, oh my goodness, this was God's plan all along.
Yeah.
And what if I had missed it?
Right, right. Yeah. That's, you know, as you're thinking back on that journey, I'm curious about a high point for you as maybe a practitioner, as a scholar, a time when you felt engaged and motivated, an experience that has you would say has really shaped you as an anthropologist, as a missiologist. Tell us about that.
Boy, there's a lot, but probably it happened in July 1975. I was a graduate student, and I had read this article by Charles Kraft called Dynamic Equivalence Churches, published in the journal Missiology, of which I would become the editor many, many years later.
Yeah.
And so I attended my first American Society of Missiology annual meeting. It was a young organization at that time, and Chuck Kraft was there. And so I'm actually a rather shy person. Most people don't know that, but I am. I'm very introverted. And so on the last night of the conference, I screwed up enough courage to go and introduce myself to Kraft. And I said to him, I said, you know, I really enjoyed your article on dynamic equivalence churches in the journal Missiology. Well, anytime you flatter someone about their article, they're going to want to have a conversation.
You know what? Let's go to coffee. Let me tell you more about it.
Well, it was dinner time. And so he said, are you sitting with anyone? And I said, no. He said, well, let's sit together. So we sat down at a table around 7 o'clock. About 1 o'clock in the morning, we pulled ourselves away.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was love at first sight.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like you had nothing to talk about. It sounds like you had nothing in common. I mean, a lot of staring in silence.
I'm 28 years old, and Kraft is 44 at the time. Yeah.
Okay.
And
okay.
So he asked me the question, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, well, I want to have about 20 years of cross-cultural ministry experience, but eventually I want to become like you. I want to use my training as an anthropologist to better serve the mission of God. And he said, well, if you want to become like me, you better come out to Fuller and see what we do. He said, we have a position called called Visiting Scholar, and we'll put you in that. He said, you can sit in our classes. He said, well, I'll hire you to be my assistant, and we'll have you teach a course or two. So
okay.
I was studying for my final doctoral exam, and I could do that anywhere. So we moved to Pasadena from Illinois. And
okay. You're talking about you and your wife, right?
At this point. Yeah, my wife and I.
And how long have you been married at that point?
4 years.
What's her name again?
Her name is Lori.
What's your wife's name? Lori, okay.
Lori, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, yeah, in fact, I called her the next morning. I said, how would you like to move to Pasadena? She says, I'm packing.
Okay, all right. That's fair. She's ready to move. I don't think my wife would do that. Like, she'd be like, you know what? Do you have a plan? Like, tell me what this is going to look like. It sounds like Lori was game.
But I would clearly say that was the high point because, well, not necessarily the high point, but a critical turning point.
Mm-hmm.
Because, right. and I was there for a year and a half. I eventually passed my doctoral exams and went off and did my field work. But not only did I meet Kraft, but I also met Alan Tippett. And Alan Tippett had written this incredible book called Solomon Islands Christianity. And in that book, he did a research on why the Methodist mission had gone off the rails. And a sort of a syncretistic cult had emerged out of that. And he was comparing what the Methodists did wrong with what the Anglicans, according to him, did everything right.
Okay.
He said, but
there was no agenda behind it, though.
So he said, you know, really looking at the Anglicans is really a dissertation level research. And he says, but needs to be a Christian. And he says, I think you're the guy to do it. I said, really? He said, absolutely. So off I went, and it's a wonderful story about how we got there and all, but don't have time for that.
Was that another one of those calling Lori and saying, "Hey, we're how do you feel about the Solomon Islands?"
Well, so I guess I will tell the story. That was the problem. I applied for all these anthropological foundation grants and stuff, and got turned down by everybody. And the reason for it is because anthropologists knew that missionaries destroy culture. So who was this young graduate student who wanted to investigate this?
Applying from the School of World Mission, right? That's on your CV or?
No, there was no reference to that at all.
They knew by the project description that
it was Southern Illinois University, which is where I was doing my PhD. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
So all that to say that we had only enough money to send me. Mm. So Lori moved in with her sister, and I budgeted $2,000 a day, $2,000 for 3 months for 100 days, because I had to do archival research in Hawaii, Fiji, New Zealand, and Australia. At the end of those 3 months, I had not spent $2,000. I had spent $200.
Okay.
And most of it was on books and ice cream. Because what happened is when I went to one place to another, people would call ahead and say, you know, we got this young American researcher out here. He's looking at the impact of the Melanesian mission. And could you put him up for a couple of days? And that happened all the way through. Just a miracle.
That's fantastic.
This is back in the days of telegrams. I send Lori a telegram from Sydney. I said, I have $1,800 left over. Buy a ticket. I'll meet you in the Solomon Islands. And that's one of the few times, and certainly the first time.
That's fantastic.
Where I cried tears of joy when I saw her plane coming down through the clouds and landing there on the island of Guadalcanal.
And what a beautiful moment. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So that she could enjoy those ice creams and the books with you. And...
Well, no, now that was New Zealand. When we got to Solomon Islands, there wasn't any ice cream.
No ice cream. Oh, man. Okay. Well, she must really love you. She was there. And so so tell us about some of those high points during that time for you.
Well, I said, how much money do you have? And she told me how much money she had, not how much money I had. We had $240. I said, but that's okay. We're here. I mean, we're not going to worry about it. So we bought mosquito nets and mattresses. And the Anglican bishop, who was a Solomon Islander, had arranged for us to live in a village on the island of Santa Isabel. And they had built us a house. And I'm going to show you a picture in just a minute here.
Okay.
And so we moved in there, lived exactly like the rest of the people. The only running water we had was as fast as I could carry it up in two buckets from the river.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
No electricity, none of those things. And actually, we saw that as an incredible privilege to be living at the level of most human beings, as most human beings have lived for thousands and thousands of years. And yet we were modern people, aware of the rest of the world. And it was just a great experience. We just loved it there. And Lori played a really important role in our research. And so while we were there, I met an Australian missionary, and he found out about my research. He says, listen, what you're discovering and learning is going to be useful for all of the Solomon Islands. Hmm. He said, the World Council of Churches has a scholarship for doing exactly this kind of thing. He said, why don't you apply for it? And I said, okay. I'm not going to apply for one more thing and get turned down. I said, but if you want to apply for me, go ahead. Well, he did. And the 3 months later, I'm back in the capital city, and I see him. And he says, well, you got the scholarship. He says, $4,000, and they want to know if you want Australian money or American money. Now, meanwhile, Alan Tippett had retired from Fuller and had moved to Canberra. And he said, why don't you come to Australia and get started on your dissertation? I'll work with you. Now, remember, he is not my mentor in official sense, but he's my true doctor father in absolutely every way. So that worked out, and our son was born there. Our son was made in the Solomon Islands, born in Australia, raised in New Guinea.
that's wonderful. That's such a missionary kid. I love it.
So here is the book edition of the.
Okay, I'm going to do a screenshot of this so that we can put this. We'll post it underneath the underneath our podcast. Give me 1 second. Hold it right there.
the cover was drawn by my sister-in-law, and that's actually what our house looked like up on stilts.
Wow.
And Alan Tippett wrote the foreword to it. Just a wonderful foreword.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Wow. That's really cool. What year was that published?
1983.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 1983.
Our field work was done 1977-78.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've already begun to name some of these primary relationships that really contributed to your research, to your ministry. I'm thinking here about Tippett, your wife, Lori, an important conversation with Charles Kraft. What were some of those other relationships or those, you know, this people that contributed to your research?
Well, I would say there's a few more. One of the really more important one is Paul Hebert. Paul, in my estimation, is the dean of missiological anthropology.
Okay.
And just such a creative person, a gentle spirit. Unfortunately, he died at age 74.
Yeah.
Never made it even to 75. he was just a great encourager of me. Mm. And his famous book, Anthropological Insights for Missionaries, he sent to me as a manuscript. And he'd been working with this material, teaching in Singapore at the Haggai Institute.
Okay.
And so I read the manuscript, sent him back a lot of suggestions, and later it was published.
That's fantastic.
And it sold over 60,000 copies, that particular book.
Yeah. So when you think about conversations that you had with Hebert, you mentioned that he was an encouragement for you. It sounds like he was a significant model for you in what you were aiming to become and aiming to be and have become. I'm curious, as you think back on specific conversations or moments with Hebert, what comes to mind for you?
Well, there is one that happened probably close to when he died. And I remember it because I was on an airplane and getting ready to taxi. I was going somewhere in the world. And I called Paul and I said, Paul, I just want you to know how much I love you and what a great elder brother you have been to me. And I said, I also have to say, I've always felt intimidated by you because you're just at a whole another level from where I am. And Paul returns back. He said, well, thank you for that. But he said, you know, he says, you have gifts and graces that I don't have. And you have audiences that you reach that I never will. Hmm. He said, the Lord creates us for different times and different spaces among different people. And God has given you a remarkable avenue of ministry through your anthropology. And that was very, very encouraging, really.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. That's a very different message than maybe you received early on as a young person that's being rejected for the grants. That is, that you know you're thought of as expendable by the state, 1969. This is a very different message. This is someone, a man of God saying, actually, you are created beautifully, wonderfully for a specific time and place, and God has a purpose for you.
When Chuck Kraft read Alan Tippett's foreword, he called me up. He says, well, it's obvious who Tippett is leaving his mantle to.
Okay. That's fantastic. I love that. Yeah, I love that.
That was one of those great, great lines, right?
Those are two important phone calls. I love that. It just a lot of affirmation from a prior generation, just a lot of affirmation from both Hebert and from Kraft.
I was in Australia in 2016. Tippett had three daughters and no sons and was a missionary for 20 years in Fiji before he went and worked on a PhD in anthropology. So he was 52 when he got his anthropology degree. And so I was doing some teaching, lecturing in Australia, and I met his daughter, Joan. And we went out to dinner, and I might choke up here. She said, I heard my dad say to my mom one day, "You know, I never had a son, but if I had had, I would have wanted him to be Daryl Whiteman."
Oh, wow.
And wow. Wow. That was more than a mantle.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful memory.
A couple other people who have been important for me are Eugene Nida, arguably the foremost Bible translator in the world. I wrote him, he wrote the first, he essentially wrote the first Anthropology for Christian Mission book. Hmm. And that was this one here, Customs and Cultures, 1954. And
can you hold that back up again? I'm going to get a screenshot because it's one of those ones that I want to make sure I include this for the folks that are listening to the podcast, but would like to be able to see the cover. Got it. Thank you.
Okay. So as a graduate student, I write him. I say, you know, I'm preparing to get a degree in anthropology to serve mission. And do you have any suggestions or advice on how I should proceed? Hmm. Well, I never expected to hear from someone like that.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, he wrote me back a personal letter.
Wow.
And later I came to know him quite well. We celebrated his 75th birthday in our home. When I was at Asbury Seminary, I invited him a couple times. So another person who really was influential for me was Andrew Walls, who finally went to be with the Lord last year at age 92.
And
Andrew was another one of those giants who encouraged these young kids who didn't know half of what he knew, but that didn't bother him. And so the Lord has really connected me with just wonderful saints. And I realized that that I have now been able to pass on the blessing that came from me to many others. And that's kind of the life I've wanted to live, is passing on to others what God has given to me. One day, a student was leaving my office at Asbury, and they just stopped and says, "I want to thank you for really pouring your life into me. You know, you're not a normal professor." And I said, "Well, thank you for thanking me, but here's how you really can thank me. Your day will come when you'll have an opportunity, and you'll thank me when you pour your life into someone else."
Yes.
And that's the way I've kind of tempted to live.
That's wonderful. I want to ask you about God's agency in your life. Tell me about a time, a moment, a memory where you recognized it was one of those moments, and it could have been something that you recognized in retrospect, but a moment that you knew God was shaping you as a scholar, as a practitioner, as a man of God.
Yeah, I do have one. Now, remember, I wanted to serve in Papua New Guinea for 20 years. Tippett was my model for that. Kraft had served in Nigeria for 4 miserable years.
Yeah.
And Tippett had served for 20 years in Fiji. Kraft was the better teacher, the more engaging, better teacher. But Tippett had a depth of experience about him. And so I wanted to combine Kraft and Tippett.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring the best of both. So in 83, I received 3 invitations to join the faculties of schools that were looking for a missiological anthropologist. And one of those was Asbury. And I wasn't interested in any of them. And I told everybody I wasn't interested. And But Asbury tricked me into coming. I said, "I'm happy to come and help you find someone as a consultant, but I am not a candidate. You need to know that." They said, "Yeah, we understand that." So as soon as I arrived, we were on a furlough in the States, living in Seattle, and getting ready to go back to New Guinea, which we did.
Yeah.
And about 3 weeks later. So when I arrive, I realize, oh my goodness, this is a full court press to get me to join them. I mean, they pull out all the stops. And I remember the after a day of talking with the provost and meeting others, going to bed that night in the guest house, and I felt like Jacob wrestling with the angel. I just could not fall asleep.
Yeah.
And about 4 o'clock, I remember certainly saying to myself, if not verbally, damn it, Lord. If this means for me to be faithful in following you that I have to come here, I'm willing to do it, but I don't want to. And the next morning, the provost noticed something different about my countenance. Mm. He said, how'd you sleep last night? I said, miserable.
Yeah.
Until about 4 o'clock. I said, I'm more willing to think about it. I said, now I'm not available when you want me, which was the following year.
Okay.
But, the provost said, well, should we get Lori on the phone and have her get a ticket and fly here immediately from Seattle?
Yeah.
I said, no.
Yeah.
I said, that's not necessary. She's actually been to Wilmore before. If we come here, it has nothing to do with the location. It'll have everything to do with really feel God is calling us to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So Lori meets me back at the airport, Seattle, flying from Lexington. And we're driving along, going back to the place where we're living. She said, how was your trip? I said, oh, it was okay. Dead silence. And she said, we're going to Asbury, aren't we? I said, well, honey, I don't know. I said, we won't make the decision until we get back home to Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
Discuss with my colleagues there, because leaving there left a void.
Right, right.
Remember, there aren't very many missiological anthropologists in the world. Mm-hmm. Oh, I got to tell you this. Asbury was looking for PhD anthropologists with missionary experience in the Wesleyan tradition.
Okay.
You know how many there were in the world?
Two of you?
There were two.
That was just a guess.
And the other was a woman in Kenya. And they said, well, it'd be good to have a female as the founding faculty. And so they interviewed her, and just as a matter of due diligence, they checked out her PhD at Tulane University. And lo and behold, she never had it.
Oh, no. Oh,
she
goodness.
She never had it.
Oh.
She was ABD, all but dissertation.
Oh, and, no.
But people started calling her doctor, and,
It stuck.
It stuck. And having mentored 40 or 50 PhD students now, I can see how that can happen.
Right.
I mean, it's subtle, but I can see how it happened.
Yeah.
Now they were down to just one.
Yeah. Their pool is not very large that they're drawing from. I mean, they knew they had to pull out all the stops.
I'm only 36 years old. You know, I said, no, wait, just give me at least 10 more years. But they were desperate. Now, and the reason I say that is a highlight, because it became very clear to me that this was God's plan for my life.
Yeah.
And when I finally got there, I says, I'll stay for 3 years because it costs you so much to get me from New Guinea, but I won't stay a day past 10. I'm heading back. I said, this is, and it at year 11, I had a sabbatical in Singapore.
Okay.
And Lori and I looked for overseas positions again. And it just became so clear, no, this is where I belong.
Mm.
And the next 10 years at Asbury were even more effective.
Mm.
And so it was a, It was just a great, great experience. Mm-hmm.
When you think about your own contribution to missiology, this broader conversation that we refer to as missiology, what have been those key ideas or concepts, ways that you've contributed to the conversation that you would say are the most important, the most significant?
Two things. I'm probably known more for my writing on contextualization than anything else. And in 1996, I was invited to do the keynote address for the American Society of Missiology. And that year, Dean Gilliland was the president. And the president chooses the topic and invites the speakers. And he was all about contextualization. And so I wrote my presentation on my back. I was suffering from intense back pain. And in fact, I'd been in the hospital waiting for surgery, and Humana Insurance decided they weren't going to pay for it a half hour before I was to be wheeled down to the operating room.
No. Oh, man.
So I was in excruciating pain. And I remember laying on my back writing this article or this presentation. And eventually it came together. And the night I gave it at the keynote address for the opening of the American Society of Missiology meetings, this was June 1996.
Okay.
And I was all pumped up with pain pills, but I got through it. And Jerry Anderson, who was the editor of the International Bulletin of Mission Research, of Missionary Research, made a beeline for the podium as soon as I was finished. He says, I want to publish your article, your presentation in the International Bulletin of Missionary Research. I said, well, actually, all the presentations are to be published in the January issue of Missiology.
Yeah.
And then Jerry says, well, it wouldn't look very good for you to publish your own presentation. I was the editor of Missiology at that point.
So. I got it.
And of course,
he got
I
wasn't
worried
about
I could care less about that. So I said, well, let me ask around. And thanks for your affirmation. But let me ask around and see what people think. So I did, and everyone who I talked to said, yeah, well, I think that'd be a great idea. And so I told him, okay. So in the January issue of Missiology, my article wasn't there, but all the rest of them on contextualization was. But in the January issue of International Bulletin of Missionary Research for 1997, my article was the lead article. And they did a fabulous job of copy editing and really turning that into a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. And that article is quoted over and over again. It's been republished many times. And
what's the title of that article? What's the title?
Contextualization, mm-hmm. : the theory, the gap, the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when my students read it, they said, Whiteman, this one article captures everything you've been teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So I think I'm probably known in that field, and then just this year I've published two articles in India, one on why is Christianity perceived as a foreign religion in India, mm-hmm. and another one was published a couple months ago. I think it's titled. Oh, just a minute, I'll get the title. Contextualization: a passing fad, a syncretistic danger, or a biblical model.
Mm, okay, that's good.
And so that's, and probably in terms of the academic stuff, that's probably what I'll be known for more than anything else. But in terms of where I think I'm making the best contribution is in the training of missionaries. Mm. And I have probably trained 5,000 or 6,000 over 40 years. And the theme that comes through in that is my whole concept of incarnational identification. That is, in the same way that God became Jesus the Jew, emptied himself of all the power, the position, the privilege of being God's son, mm-hmm. we also need to thoroughly identify with the culture and the people among whom we go and empty ourselves of our power, our position, our prestige, and our posture. And that theme just keeps driving me over and over again. And today I'm training a lot of Chinese missionaries. Just the last 2 weeks, I got up every morning at 2 o'clock to begin teaching from 3 to 7 every day for 58 Chinese missionaries.
Wow.
And this is the dominant theme that comes through. And I just finished 2 weeks of teaching at Nagaland Bible College in India. And it's the same theme. And so people say, you know, we know incarnation as a theological doctrine, but we've never really recognized it as a model for how we need to do mission. Mm. And so that's a driving force for me. Mm. I think the other thing is that as an anthropologist, I've been fascinated by what happens to culture when it is encountered by the gospel. And And I oftentimes say this, that if Christianity is true, and there's a possibility it isn't, we have to hold that out. Mm-hmm. But if Christianity is true, and I believe it is, then that means that anyone in any culture at any period of human history can become a follower of Jesus without having to abandon their culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a phrase that I use a lot these days is one does not have to deny their birth identity in order to affirm their second birth identity as a follower of Jesus. And what this leads to is an understanding of Muslim followers of Jesus, Hindu followers of Jesus. And so over and over again, I am reminded and remind others that Jesus did not come to earth to start a new religion called Christianity. Jesus came to earth to usher in and announce the kingdom of God. And we have just incorporated so much extra stuff around the simple message of Jesus that that people are really turned off. And so in our own society here in the United States, I find that younger people are turned off to church. They see churches against everything, but they are interested in Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so how do we make that kind of distinction?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
As an anthropologist, understanding the concept of culture, it's helped me really make that kind of distinction that my culture is what influences how I read the Bible, how I understand following Jesus. But others do not have to do the same thing that I do because their culture is different.
Mm-hmm.
And that opens the door for contextualization, you see.
Yeah. That's that. I love that. What would you say is, you know, what would you say is the distinction between you had mentioned Tippett's challenge in the Solomon Islands, partly dealing with, or what he's addressing syncretism. So when you think about the difference between syncretism and what you're describing, this kind of contextualization, what's the line there? What's the distinction?
Okay. Well, for one thing, to start with, to ask the question, where do I draw the line, is the wrong question. Contextualization is taking the meaning, biblical meanings, and applying them in the context of the people so the biblical meanings has all the more truth and power and meaning to it. Mm-hmm. Therefore, contextualization is the best hedge against syncretism, not the slippery slope that leads to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is syncretism? Syncretism, then, is a mixture of Christian forms with non-biblical meanings. So the form and meaning complex, which is behind a lot of my teaching, that helps us make the distinction between contextualization, where the form is cultural and the meaning is biblical, in contrast to syncretism, where the form is oftentimes Western, but the meaning is non-biblical. So here's an example. When we lived in the village of Nuluhage in the Solomon Islands, I've never been so religious in all my life because Anglicans had morning prayer and evening prayer every day. And I would attend a little tiny chapel and count the people and record what was being, the scripture, everything.
Yeah.
About every 3 or 4 months, an Anglican bishop, excuse me, an Anglican priest would come by and serve a communion. And now this was a Solomon Island. All the Europeans had gone home. They had left. It was all in the Solomon Islands. And I would notice that everybody in the village would attend the night before, which was the night of confession, and the next morning for Holy Communion. So I said, why do so few people come to morning and evening prayers, but everybody comes to Holy Communion? So I asked around, and they said, I said, why do you go to communion but not prayers? Well, Holy Communion, we get holy food. We get sacred food. I said, what do you mean by that? Well, I mean the food that builds us up. And I said, you mean manna? And the look on their face, how did you know? Now, let me tell you what manna is. Manna is the Melanesian word for supernatural power. And the way that the Solomon Islanders received mana two generations ago was lopping off the head of an enemy and eating the brains and drinking the blood. And in the process would gain all that supernatural power. So now Holy Communion was giving them mana in the same way as eating the brains and drinking the blood of deposed enemies. Mm-hmm. It just was a lot easier to do.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's someone's providing it.
So there is an example of syncretism where the form looked Christian, but the meaning behind it had nothing to do with remembering what Jesus had done for us. Mm-hmm. It was all about, this is another way to get the supernatural power.
Yeah. 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 You know, it's one of the challenges that I personally, when I think about, you know, trying to distinguish the form and the meaning, it's precisely what you're running into in that story, which is, you know, how much access do I have to a person's meaning, right? What they understand, what is it like, what is it that they're making sense of when we talk about, say, a concept like Jesus as the Son of God, right? Or Jesus as divine, both God, you know, and human, in, you know, let's talk about incarnation. And, you know, so much of Western history, we've talked about that very relationship, right? How do we talk about Jesus as fully God and fully human? How is it that we understand that? And so often, you know, we even say the right words and we think that people have the right meaning. And then you start really digging in and you realize, actually, that, you know, what you believe is actually a heresy, right? Like the way you describe it, people have been excommunicated for that. And my guess is that as we start to kind of pick people's, you know, really start to, if we could work from top to bottom and start working through, you know, your ideas of God and my ideas of God, your ideas of Jesus, that we would find discrepancies there. And in ways that you might say, your meaning is off, right? Or, you know, your form is right, but your meaning is off. That for me is one of the biggest challenges that I see in my own ministry and my scholarship as well. How have you encountered that?
Well, that's a great question, because our tendency is to want to control how the receptor understands and forms meaning. And that is not our job. Our job is to tell the story of Jesus and to live as if we believed it was actually true. And then trust the Holy Spirit to lead people to the deeper levels of meaning and understanding. But the problem is we don't trust the Holy Spirit to guide other people. We only trust the Holy Spirit to guide ourselves. So we maneuver and make sure that the church planted there looks exactly like the church planted home at home. And we do that to safeguard it. But in the process, we actually open the door for syncretism. Mm. Does that make sense?
How so? Unwrap that for me.
Because we're insisting that they have the same forms of Christianity that I have in my culture.
Okay.
Assuming that if they have the same forms, they therefore will have the same meanings.
Okay, I understand.
That's where we run amok. That's where we make the mistake.
Yeah.
And so at the level of meaning, we simply have to trust the Holy Spirit to lead and to guide people. Now, Paul Hebert, in his great article, Critical Contextualization, lays out a pattern of four steps that you take. Now, there is a role for us as the outsider, but our role really needs to be diminished, and a lot more trust in the Holy Spirit to guide new believers in what in their culture needs to be rejected, what in their culture needs to be affirmed, what in their culture needs to change to be an expression of what it means to be a follower of Jesus in their culture.
Yeah. Love that. I love that.
I had a lot of fun with the students at Nagaland Bible College, because they kept saying, well, we got to tell those people what to do because what they're doing is wrong. I said, no, that's not our job. Mm. What do you mean it's not our job? That's what missionaries do.
Yeah.
I said, well, maybe missionaries do it, but cross-cultural witnesses don't. And it's the only model they had.
Right. You
know, inherited from Western missionaries who came. And that's what the missionary told them. So now it's their term. And now they're going to do exactly the same way. So they just couldn't believe the stuff I was teaching. They said, we've never heard this before. I said, no, yeah, I'm sure you haven't.
Yeah. And this goes back to something you mentioned early on, which is, you know, it really is this process of giving up power and position, prestige, right? This giving up is very much a part of this cross-cultural engagement, this me sharing this message with you and living out God's kingdom realities in your presence and in relationship with you.
Exactly. That's exactly key. Right. Yep. Yep. Yep.
Here's a question for you. And I know we've gone over time. I really appreciate your generosity here.
That's fine. As soon as I finish with you, I got a great paper. So,
oh, you and me both. You and me both. It's the best part of our job. I mean, you know, it's why we get into this. So here's a question. When you're thinking about your own journey of faith, where is a time where you sensed, you knew that the Holy Spirit was shifting something for you? I mean, we talk about trusting the Holy Spirit to shift things for people who are, you know, maybe understanding the gospel for the very first time. But it happens with us. It happens with you and me. It happens with everybody, right? Because we don't come with everything nicely packed up. So the Spirit of God is also shifting us and our beliefs and our understanding, our praxis. When is the time that that's happened for you?
I think it's happening in these latter years of my life when I see the impact of what I'm teaching. And when missionary candidates, people involved in cross-cultural ministry, their response to a week of teaching, for example, will be, wow, I've never heard this before. And if I had heard this teaching before, it would have made a huge difference in my ministry. And almost with anger, why did I hear this before? I said, well, you probably never met a missiological anthropologist, because when the anthropologist reads the scriptures, it's a different lens through which we're looking. We're asking different kinds of questions. And we talk a lot more about the humanity of Jesus as a person who was a Jew born into an Aramaic-speaking, Palestinian, Roman-occupied culture. So we talk a lot more about the humanity of Jesus and let the theologians talk about the divinity of Christ.
Yeah.
And when we do that, we see things about Jesus we never saw before. And so I'm finding that these latter years where I'm engaged all over the world and teaching and training is just an affirmation that what I've given my life to has actually been the right thing.
That's powerful. What would you say if you had two wishes, three wishes for shaping the future shape of mission theology, maybe thinking about the next decade or two? What are your hopes for our field?
Probably more to do with mission practice than mission theology. I think we got enough theology.
Okay.
I think what bothers me a lot is that the message that I am teaching, preaching, living out should have been understood and practiced a long time ago. And why is it we're still, now granted, Western missionaries are on the decline, but the non-Western, the majority world missionaries are increasing in rapid number. And they have all the problems that the colonial missionaries from America and Europe had 100 years ago. They confuse culture with gospel. They don't go prepared. They're not incarnational. And so I guess my wish would be that as part of the training, missionary candidates are equipped to not only understand the content of their message, but also equipped to understand and discover the context in which that message will be delivered. So content and context. When we graduate people from seminary, they're high on content and very low on ability to understand the context. And that's necessary for pastors in this country. And I would rather, I'd like to see this come up a little bit more balanced. Now, the problem is, are we going to find more missiological anthropologists out there? I oftentimes say we're a cult of six. And the problem is that we're all getting old. I mean, I'm 75 going on 57. And Mary Madeney is one of the great ones. Dan Shaw, one of the great ones. They're all approaching 80. And I don't really see a lot of younger people coming in into this field. And so that's a wish that I would have, that our small tribe would increase.
That's great. Anything else? Any other wishes that you'd throw in there?
No, I don't think so. I think this is I guess I want to make sure that the academic field of missiology never gets disconnected from the practice of mission. Now, this is starting to happen, and there's a new term that's coming into the academic world. It's called world Christianity. It's the hot topic now, world Christianity. And it's mostly done through the lens of history and theology, not through the lens of mission practice. Now, what's interesting, in Europe, you won't find hardly one missiological anthropologist. When they study mission and missiology, they study history and theology. It's the American expression of missiology which focuses more on the role of the social sciences. And so I just wish we had more of that. So I'm a little concerned that world Christianity is going to take off. Well, going to, it is. Schools which got rid of their mission professors years ago are now suddenly getting getting chairs of world Christianity and inviting non-Western people to occupy them. So it's a fad. It's a trend. That's great. I don't have any problem with it at all. But let's not get disconnected from the actual practice of mission. That's what we're called to do. I never got a PhD in anthropology to be a professor. Never my intention at all. I got a PhD in anthropology because I thought I'd become a better missionary. And that was my goal from the beginning and is my goal now. Yeah, it hasn't changed.
Let's end on that note. I love that. So I want to say on behalf of our listeners at Missiology Podcast and on behalf of all of us at missiology.com, thank you again, Daryl Whiteman. This has been a fantastic interview, and I appreciate your openness. We here at Missiology Podcast are all about, you know, doing our best to bridge that practice and theory. And part of the reason we're doing this whole podcast is we want people to have access to great thinkers. And sometimes they're not willing to pick up a book, but they are willing to, you know, listen to a podcast as they're walking. And we want these ideas out there, not just for those of us who are in the West, but thanks to the internet, missiology.com we have access to the world. And so I want to thank you once again for your voice, for helping bring some of that expertise, some of that great theology, that great thinking, your own experiences all together. And, anyway, thank you. It's been a gift.
Well, I've enjoyed it. You're a good interviewer. You ask good questions, and a good interview knows what to draw out of people. And you did a nice job of that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Daryl. Well, with that, we're signing off.